From Uniontown to Warminster, Ridgeway to Reading, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, Pennsylvania's state-related universities are awash in controversy, but that isn't stopping them from asking for more taxpayer dollars. State Representative Eric Nelson is here to explain why the time has come to fund students, not institutions. Taking aim at reducing the suicide rate among veterans, the USAA has launched Face the Fight with the goal of cutting that rate in half by 2030. Joe Geiger has Amish Vicaria of USAA in the Community Benefit Spotlight. And massive illegal immigration at the nation's southern border continues to be a major problem. For an update, Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania has this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to State Representative Eric Nelson in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. It appears mail-in voting in Pennsylvania is here to stay. The Commonwealth Court this past week rejected a request to throw out the state's mail-in ballot law. Republican lawmakers had challenged the law on the grounds that the state Supreme Court had declined to support a provision in that law relative to the dating of ballots, thus invalidating the entire law. Commonwealth Court, however, ruled that the remainder of the law must stand. That ruling is likely to be appealed back to the Supreme Court. This could get interesting. Allegheny County District Attorney Stephen Zappala lost the Democratic primary to a left-wing challenger backed by George Soros. But Zappala received enough write-in votes to secure the Republican nomination. In a November rematch, Zappala could attempt to combine GOP votes with mainstream Democratic votes to win re-election over progressive challenger Chief Public Defender Matt Dugan. SEPTA, the Southeastern Pennsylvania Transit Authority, is suffering from both a decline in ridership and it is hemorrhaging money. Despite that, the federal government has seen fit to give the authority $80 million to lower bus emissions. According to the Center Square, previous electric bus purchases have left SEPTA with dozens of broken-down buses, so replacing more diesel buses with electric buses raises issues of potential service disruptions. In the meantime, SEPTA is facing a $240 million operational shortfall. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Republican lawmakers are refusing to reauthorize funding to Pennsylvania's state-related universities after they refused to agree to a tuition freeze. It is just the latest controversy to engulf Penn State University and the University of Pittsburgh. State Representative Eric Nelson represents the 57th Legislative District in Westmoreland County and has a proposal that would end state funding of institutions and instead fund students. He is here to talk about it. Eric, welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. Eric, this past week, the House of Representatives had before it an appropriation for the state-related universities, specifically Pitt, Penn State, and Temple. Explain to us the funding differences here. What are state-related universities as opposed to state system? How does that funding system work?
It's interesting, and historically, Pennsylvania had a much larger number of state-related schools. There used to be as many as 12 to 14 state-related schools, and through the years, they dropped down. And a state-related is kind of a different category that is special funding with their own line item in the budget, but in exchange for that, they require a two-thirds vote in order to have that funding applied. So they're still their own entity, but they receive an individual funding line item. And part of the problem with that line item is it's one of the few areas in Harrisburg where there is no accountability about what happens to that money once it crosses over into the university. And that's what really draws a lot of controversy about the state-related funding.
And this past week, it required that two-thirds vote in order to be approved. Republicans in the State House lined up against approving that funding. What was the reason for that? What are the concerns that lawmakers have with this funding to the state-related universities?
There was a substantial bit of, you know, resistance both from leadership and rank-and-file members. Part of that process, I think, from a leadership perspective, is that they felt they have been blocked out and not involved in the discussions, and they were wanting to say, hey, we want a voice at the table. If you want our votes, then you need to engage with us in the broader aspect of the funding. The other part, which is a pretty considerable and growing majority within the Republican side, is the thought process that this funding should go to students versus going to the universities. But probably one of the biggest areas of controversy was the uneven amount of money that Governor Shapiro proposed that the state-relateds get versus PASHE schools, which are our state schools, and community college. It was really a like multi-million dollar funding difference, $40 million of extra money going to these three schools versus a 2% increase or $11 million going to all of the PASHE schools and all of the community college. So this issue of equitable treatment for all students showed up not only in the college voucher concept, but really just in the direct funding and the amount that these very powerful universities will receive as compared to other schools, independent schools, private schools, and community colleges.
Interesting that you would bring up the issue of a voucher program. In other words, funding students instead of funding institutions. There have been a wide range of controversies relative to these state-related universities. We're going to talk a little bit more about some of those. But one way to sidestep all of that would be to fund students. So tell us a bit about your proposal for funding students rather than institutions.
I'm a strong believer of the free market, transparency, and competition. And one of the biggest challenges that families have, I mean, I have seven kids and our number four is going to be heading, he's graduating and heading into college. So I had no idea the amount of confusion and how things really worked in the area of funding, tuition, loans. And one of the things that's missing from the conversation is really the opportunity for those taxpayer dollars, which is over $1 billion, get spent every year, Loman, going to our post-secondary schools, but our families really don't see it. They see a very, very small portion in what is referred to as FIA grants. And that is an independent entity that all students that are attending college, kind of when they fill out their financial paperwork, it qualifies them for grants through the state of Pennsylvania, not loans. And the concept of the college voucher program is to build FIA up because it is currently underfunded and empower students and families. Imagine if upon graduation, that young adult was going to get a $6,000 or an $8,000 voucher to apply wherever they wanted to. So this could be maybe they want to go to a technical school. Maybe they want to go to a community college, which would cover, that would mean free community college for all Pennsylvanians without raising taxpayer money. It's not a matter of the dollars aren't there. It's just a matter of who is receiving them. And that's really what we're looking to try to improve.
We are talking with State Representative Eric Nelson of the 57th Legislative District, that in Westmoreland County, about his proposal to directly fund students rather than institutions. And Eric, taking a look, there was reports in the news this past week where a number of these state-related universities, and the article specifically talked about Pitt and Penn State, they've seen declining enrollment in their branch campuses. We see declining enrollment in colleges and universities all across the board in Pennsylvania. As you look at their demand for all this more money, have they undertaken any efforts to try to bring their costs under control or to consolidate or economize in any way rather than simply come back to the state taxpayers and ask for more money?
This common cry, the town crier of more money is the solve to their issues. And unfortunately, Loman, they have not implemented cost controls or containment. As a matter of fact, they also have refused multiple attempts for transparency. House Republicans and Representative Warner from Fayette County has been the champion of a bill that just says you're receiving, I mean, this is over $600 million that just these three schools receive. And he says that should qualify for the right to know. Right now, those state-related universities do not even have to be subject to right to know. So not only are they not curbing costs, but they're not even disclosing how the money is being spent. And it is really, of all the nooks and crannies of the budget, some of just the, it's just a heightened level of comfort, I guess I should say, that has grown since the 1960s, when originally these schools were struggling and they were added to the state related for extra funding. And if we look back through from the 60s to now, we can really get a picture of, has this policy worked or has it not worked?
So they're asking for all this additional funding here, Eric, and as you pointed out, there's a lack of transparency. Are these universities willing to make a pledge to lawmakers, to all of you, that if you give them this additional money, they will pass that cost savings on to students by not raising tuition over the next year?
Well, that is a that's a great question, Loman, and really, through the we've been battling this issue for the last several budgets, and credit to Penn State, the commitments that they have made, let's say through COVID, we had a lot of concerns about vaccine mandates from the Republican side of the aisle. Voluntary vaccine, hey, that's an individual's choice. But Penn State committed as part of that process that they weren't going to mandate vaccines with their funding. University of Pittsburgh also made the same commitment prior to their funding vote. And then 6 weeks after they got their money, they flipped and got an extra $30 or $40 million from the federal government and mandated those vaccines. The University of Pittsburgh, prior budget cycle, after they got their money, then they raised their tuition. So different universities have, some have held to their word and others have just blatantly disregarded it. And that's what makes this vote even more challenging, because when you have what is a really great learning institution intentionally not keeping their commitments to the House, which is really reflective of the taxpayers, it merely makes them very difficult to trust and negotiate with.
Funding students rather than institutions. We have been talking with State Representative Eric Nelson. He represents the 57th State Legislative District in Westmoreland County. Eric, we have listeners who may have some questions, might want to contact you or learn more. Is there a website or how can they get in touch with you?
Yes, they'd be able to reach me at repnelson.com or be able to call our Greensburg office number, 724-834-6400.
State Representative Eric Nelson. Eric, thank you for taking time to be with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Loman.
Cutting the suicide rate among U.S. veterans in half by 2030 is the goal of Face the Fight, a new project launched by USAA and its partners. In the Community Benefits Spotlight, Joe Geiger has part one of a two-part interview with Amish Vakaria of USAA. Joe?
Thank you, Loman, and thank you, Amish, for being a guest on our radio program. Amish, we're going to talk about veteran suicides. It's a quandary right now about on the number of veterans who are coming out and then ending their lives on the homeland. It just doesn't make sense that we can let this go, and you're going to address that with a program in your company. But first, Amish, if you could address how many suicides have occurred that you're aware of since 2001, and what's going on that's causing it?
Joe, I'm glad to be here today and talk about this incredibly important topic. And to your first question, since 2001, more than 120,000 veterans have died by suicide, and that's a rate at almost 1.5 times the general population. One other linked piece, which is even more troubling, is that children of suicide descendants are at 3 times greater risk of suicide in terms of when you look at the knock-on effect on the families that are impacted by this.
It really breaks your heart to hear that.
Absolutely. And, you know, the difficulties transitioning from military to civilian life, challenges in employment, financial stress, relationships, all significant risk factors increasing the chances of suicide in these families.
Not to mention the dynamics that you go through when you're a warrior and you're going through battle. We tend to underestimate the family piece of it, the emotional payment that the spouses make when their spouse is at war all the way across the world. In many of the topics we've discussed, whether it be cancer or a head injury or any number of things, it happens to the whole family when it happens to one.
You couldn't be more right about that. And I think we see that having served military families for over 100 years, even in the core area of business on financial security, that entire family unit, the military spouse, the significant other, they all serve in their own way. It's not just the person who's putting on the uniform and having to potentially go abroad. And the impacts of that service, and therefore what we owe them in supporting those families, both through service and after they transition out of the military, is significant. And that's a responsibility we don't take lightly here at USAA.
Now, we haven't been in actual combat for a few years, but the number seems to continue to trend upward. What's the cause of that?
It's actually the second leading cause of death for post-9/11 veterans. But maybe surprisingly for some is that over half of service members who die by suicide don't have a mental illness. So it can happen pretty quickly, and there's typically in response to a life stressor. And so those things make, first and foremost, like the notion of trying to destigmatize talking about it a really important first step to be able to connect folks who are at risk with the resources that are available out there.
If I'm understanding, you're saying that there's a differentiation on the cause of the suicide. One is that they just carry a lot of baggage when they come home, and the settling back into normal life, whatever that's going to be, is a piece of it. But the other piece is that with some of the physical and mental issues, I mean, the mental issues that have come along with these combat missions is just tremendous.
You're absolutely right. There's a whole host of factors across there. And when we look at combination of things from social isolation, feelings of loneliness and disconnection can contribute to higher risk. You also look at those other life stressors, and there's a lot connected as you look at elevated risk amongst those with substance abuse or PTSD and depression. And so no single factor is part of the reason why it's such a significant problem, and one that we believe is one that we need to step up for to be able to help address in a meaningful way.
This is Joe Geiger on the Lincoln Radio Program. My guest today is Amish Vakharia, the Executive Vice President and Chief Strategy and Brand Manager at USAA. We're talking about what's going on. Why do we need a program? What is it that USAA saw that made you think that we need to do something about this?
We turned 100 last year. We were founded by the military to support the military. And as we reached and started to embark on our second century service, we went back out on a new listening tour to military families to understand what are those challenges and what would they like to see USAA do to help military families. Number one on their list was mental health and veteran suicide. And so for us, as we look at embarking into the second century service, we couldn't stand on the sidelines and had to mobilize in a real way to help, as we're coining here, to help face the fight.
Talk a little bit about the physical injury and the mental injury and what the difference is as it addresses the issue of suicide.
You definitely have a host of factors across from mental stress, financial stress, transitioning, substance abuse that all come into and can be complicated or exacerbated when there's significant physical trauma for those who served. As we look at this and look to complement and building this coalition to complement the work that's already out there from the Department of Veteran Affairs, the DOD, and many other organizations, we view this as an opportunity to amplify and to fill in around the gaps. Probably one of the most impactful ways in terms of trying to measure the impact is Face the Fight's going to use dynamic modeling, which is used in very many public health programs. And that's going to inform decision-making about the policies, provision of programs, and measure the impact to direct the giving where we see the most amount of lives being saved.
You know, there's two types of injury we talked about. One's the physical injury if someone has a leg or an arm missing or both. You can see that. The second piece is the mental health issues. And a lot of times people stigmatize that as something that, well, just get over it. Why can't you move on? I would expect that the mental health issue is probably more challenging for the individual than the physical injury.
I think you're right in that it is often beneath the surface, and therefore those who are suffering, the loved ones of those who are suffering may not know, and those who are suffering may not be able to get connected to the resources that exist out there. You know, despite all of the challenges that we all have gone through over the past several years living through the COVID pandemic, I think one of the benefits of that has been it has opened up mindshare to the idea that it's okay to say when you're not okay. There is the benefit we're seeing from that in terms of greater receptivity towards discussion around mental health, around substance abuse, around saying there is the opportunity to get connected to resources and to care.
This is Joe Geiger in the Linkum Radio Program. Again, my guest today is Amish Bakaria, who's an executive in the USAA program that's going to get launched. It's called Face the Fight, and we're going to address that in an interview part two next month. Amish, if someone right now looking for a way to contact you, how can they find you?
To learn more about Face the Fight, to find help, or to join the fight, I encourage you to visit wefacethefight.org.
Thank you for helping spread that word. Back to you, Loman.
Ashley Klingensmith is back from a trip to the southern border and has a list of priorities for regaining control and making our immigration system more effective. She explains on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
Throughout 2023, Americans for Prosperity Foundation is hosting a number of southern border visits. The Pennsylvania chapter of Americans for Prosperity just returned from McAllen, Texas, traveling with staff, activists, coalition partners, and members of the media from Broad and Liberty to Harrisburg's WHP 580. And many of you listening now will read or hear the accounts from these partners. But today I wanted to share a bit about our perspective on border security and provide a few of my takeaways from the trip. Our vision for immigration is a system that prioritizes secure borders while providing orderly opportunities for legal immigration. We believe in an efficient asylum system that protects itself from exploitation and a streamlined legal immigration process that meets the needs of U.S. businesses and families. A process that is responsive to demands from U.S. sponsors who are willing to pay the costs of the petition and assume financial responsibility for the migrant is essential. America needs to change our laws. We need to leverage technology and additional personnel so that our asylum system quickly accepts applicants with strong claims of persecution while quickly rejecting and removing applicants with asylum claims that lack merit. The years of asylum backlogs have incentivized people to make weak claims and stay in the country while their case is pending. Meanwhile, people with strong claims remain in limbo. Cutting through the asylum backlogs is absolutely imperative to restoring integrity to our humanitarian systems and ensuring that they are used as they were intended. And all of the above border security strategy is needed and should include barriers in strategic locations, modernized technology and infrastructure, hiring more immigration judges and asylum officers, and streamlining legal pathways so migrants have more options than applying for asylum. There are several important needs we believe should be prioritized right now. Number one, we know that more Border Patrol agents leads to fewer attempted crossings. We must fill our current staffing vacancies, which is roughly 2,700 agents. Second, visa overstays are over half of the unlawfully present population. We need a biometric entry-exit system to better track visa overstays. Third, our economy has doubled in size and our population has increased by 30% since the last major reform to our immigration system. Millions of jobs remain unfilled, and it is imperative that we address work visas and opportunities so our immigration system is responsive to the needs and demands of the American market. We had the opportunity to visit with Chief Chris Clem, a recently retired Yuma Sector U.S. Customs and Border Protection Chief Border Patrol agent. He shared his mantra of clear is kind, meaning that when our laws and processes are clear, less people would be exploited and victimized by bad actors. He noted that floodgates were opened to abuse when President Biden issued his executive order suspending all deportations his first 100 days in office. Chief Clem shared that in October of 2020 in Yuma, there were an average of 25 arrests per day. But by President Biden's first year in office, by the end of 2021, they were averaging 1,200 arrests per day. The change in administration transformed the reality along the 2,000-mile southern border. Ultimately, a secure border and ample opportunities for legal immigration are complementary, not competing objectives. A secure border is foundational to our national security. Strengthening our inherent welcome culture while keeping Americans safe and secure is possible with political will and courage. Visit AmericansForProsperity.org to learn more. I'm Ashley Klingensmith, State Director with Americans for Prosperity. You can find us on Facebook by searching at PAAFP and on Twitter by searching at AFP Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 28 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WBFD-AM in Bedford, WHLM-AM and FM in Bloomsburg, along with WLSW-FM in Connellsville, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.
Thank you.